Welcome to a session that is looking at future technologies and medical data on the go. There are two speakers in this session. They're each going to speak for 45 minutes, and we'll build in some time for question and answer. The first presentation, entitled Mobile Computing for Public Health Experiences from the CDC's Informatics Research and Development Lab, the presenter is Dr. Tom Savell. Dr. Savell is the Director of Research and Development Unit in the Public Health Informatics and Technology Program Office. He came to the CDC in 2003 as a Public Health Informatics Fellow and has remained at the agency upon the completion of his fellowship as a medical officer. He's carried a wide variety of activities in the field of public health informatics, ranging from policy development to security monitoring. His clinical training has included both general surgery and family practice, and he has direct experience developing, using, and implementing health information systems. He's been a technology columnist for the American Medical News, as well as an on-air technology consultant for the Fox News affiliate in Houston, Texas. Dr. Savell holds a bachelor's degree from Wesleyan University and an MD degree from Mount Sinai School of Medicine. Please welcome Dr. Tom Savell.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here today. I hope you enjoy this. I'm going to give you a nice flavor of things going on in our lab with regard to mobile and other things. Please feel free to ask me questions during this process. It's the way we work. It's R&D. We like ideas and discussion and you know, just kind of, let's just have a good time doing this. So I'm going to give you a brief overview of what's going on in general with mobile, and then we'll talk a bit about the lab and how we've been involved in mobile, and then we'll talk about some of the prototypes, and you can ask questions and make fun of me. It's all part of the process. So first of all, when you think of mobile now, what do we think of? We think of now tablets, these e-readers, laptops and netbooks, and smartphones, and obviously handheld, smaller non-smartphones. Well, the point nowadays is saying nearly everybody is using a small device like this. So they say about 85% of adults use cell phones. You can get a sense of the breakdown. And 72% of U.S. adults use text messaging. And 38% of Americans use their cell phones to browse the web. As you can see, 50% of all web browsing is expected to occur on a mobile device in 3 years. Just to give you a little flavor at the end there, 17 million iPads were sold in 2010. So if this is a fad, it's a very large and long-lasting fad. Might be that internet fad, same kind of thing. This just gives you a nice flavor of what do people use these devices for. Well, you can see for browsing, texting, email, taking photos, capturing video, playing games, and yes, even occasionally using it as a phone. So this is now where it gets an interesting twist. So 9% of adult cell phone users who have a health app on their phone, you can get a sense of the demographics. What percent are between 18 and 29? What percent are 50 and older? And again, what percent are non-Hispanic, white, Latino, and African American? Just a sense of what is this demographic? Who is using these smartphone apps specifically in healthcare? So this is where it starts to get interesting, that the model, essentially the design science around mobile devices is different than you might think in the past, where, in a sense, less content is more useful. And social media is clearly a key aspect of all this, that users spend 3.1 hours a week on social networking through mobile devices. And 51% of mobile users have researched purchasing on their mobile phones while in the store. So literally, while they're in the store, about to buy something at Banana Republic, they're on the Banana Republic website. So just a quick flavor, age.gov, the White House, so clearly in the federal space, there is effort moving forward on mobile information. PubMed, Medline Plus, WebMD, we'll talk about what's going on here on the screen, but we're just talking about the movement toward sharing data through a very small device. CNN, obviously, NPR. It's just fascinating if you start to talk about the way those screens look. There's a whole design behind this, a whole user interface guide that, for example, Apple is focused on from their devices. It's called the HIG, by the way. We can talk about that at some point. So what is mobile browsing? So specifically, when you talk about mobile browsing, it is using, in this case, if we're looking at the iOS platform, specifically the iPhone, it's you're using the Safari platform, essentially the browser built into the device, and you're going to a mobile-ready web page. So just again, so when we talk about mobile browsing versus other things don't mention, this is what we talk about. And you have to save a bookmark, and you can save a little icon to your home, essentially, but that's going using the browser interface. Versus a mobile app, where you just essentially don't need to use Safari or a browsing engine, where you're using that native app, and you can see, once you run it, what you experience does not look like a browser in any way. And we can talk about that, because in many cases, the lines seem to be blurring, but they're not, and I'll talk a bit about that. So here's the kicker. When they did essentially some data collection, it appears that it's very close between those that use an app and those that use the browser. So users are split between mobile website versus mobile native complete independent apps. So I've come to really like this slide. It's very interesting because it shows the black is the browser, and the red is a downloaded app. And you can see whether it's blogs, videos, social media, music, and games, there is definitely a difference. That mostly with browsers, you're dealing with news and blogs, and with apps in general, it's music, games, and social networking. Interesting. Over time, the more time you spend with this, you do a lot of, interesting. So this is ugly slide / interesting slide. So after we talk about this slide, if you have a slight headache, that's okay, because there's a lot of gray. So the difference between an app, I use that word, that's essentially a web-based sort of customized web page versus a natively written coded app that you download. And you can see the difference. So in general, the web one is really optimized and works well if you just have a lot of text content. There's not a lot of calculation and processing. It's just, I've got just lots of text data. That will work fairly well with sort of a mobile web browser-based app. There is an advantage if you've got a website that has the mobile sort of customization that most likely, whether it's on Android or other platforms, it will look fairly good. And therefore, quickly, you say, we don't have time to write in Objective-C, let's just quickly just make a web savvy page. So in other words, HTML5, for example, and that will get you some traction fairly quickly. Those that are familiar with the website, if it has a bit of website-ish feel, those that are used to the web will immediately know how to use your app if you build it that way. There is obviously limited functionality because you can't take advantage of the core, whether it's the compass built into the device or the other, GPS functionality. The web one won't normally do that, although that appears to be changing as we see. In general, but not always, to use the web customized app, you have to be online, so that's changing. And in general, it's very difficult at times for the user to get to what the web URL was to get to your app versus just downloading the app itself. So, and then moving over to native, so the native is great. It's a lot of functionality built into the core of your hardware. It potentially can be very expensive to build, and you just have to install the app. Can be used offline. At the very end, this is based on your application design. There may be an instance where users will not have the latest content. So if they download your app and you choose to not update it, it may turn out that they've got an app that, although if they click on update, there's an update they need, but if they choose not to update it, they're not getting that new information. But this is really all in the subtlety of the architecture of the app. we can talk about that. So there's many different ways you can do things with this app design. I like that stats show that many apps are downloaded, but then they immediately stop using. So obviously there is no perfect solution. Each has its strengths and weaknesses, and I think you'll see over time that line is really blurring. So recently, just as a bit of my goal is to throw a lot of stuff your way to chew on and think on, is that in July, this past July, the FDA released draft guidance for saying, okay, if there's going to be an app in healthcare, here are some general FDA guidelines. So if yours is involved in EKG monitoring or other basically healthcare care function, there's some rules you have to meet. So currently it's in comment phase, but that exists right now. So the FDA says, you know, they want to be in on this. And there is actually already, I think it's a radiology app that was approved by the FDA, and the radiologists are actually using it for looking at scans on the iPad. This slide's kind of funky, but this is, again, just to give you a little bit of flavor. So there's a wide variety of public health apps out there already. And they range from being iPhone apps, Android, web-based. There's things called Health Map, EpiCollect, Disaster Alerts. There's already a lot of EMR and EHR-ready mobile versions for some of the large companies. So clearly, it's very clear that this is not going away. The healthcare community has rapidly now embraced the iPads and iPhones and other mobile devices in healthcare. They find that it really is very valuable at the point of care to have a reference, to look at the x-ray, look at the EKG right at that time with a very small device. But there's also a lot of movement on wearable computing and connected devices. The Fitbit is an impressive device where literally you clip it on and it keeps track of your weight and your activity, and it automatically transmits data to a website where you can watch your weight and your activity level without doing any extra effort. And that's really changing data collection overall. Before, there was a lot of effort, like I have to go in and put in my blood pressure, not anymore. And there's also tools now that you hook into, for example, your iPhone to get blood pressure monitoring, to get glucose monitoring. There's even a free app that still blows my mind, and it's a pulse ox. Pulse oximetry is where you can see oxygen, basically how well you're oxygenating. And so literally it takes the camera of the iPhone, you put it on your finger, and the light of the flash goes through your finger, and based on the color of what, essentially the way the pulse ox works, it actually is reading your pulse ox. And it's really impressive, literally, by being slick enough to use the light of the flash. I mean, it's very innovative. So things are really changing. So I'm going to hold on there for a moment. I threw a lot out there. This was sort of the overwhelming, what's the state of sort of mobile, very quickly. Any questions before we get into some prototypes and discussions about all this? And if not, keep on going. But we have time to answer any questions. No. All right. So let me give you a bit of background about our lab, so you at least get a sense of who we are and why we're messing with this stuff. So we're overall the Informatics Research and Development Unit, and within that we have a lab. And our goal is to prototype, look at new technologies, and try to figure out potential solutions to help impact public health. Saying, you know, this is a better way to do this. It's augmented reality. It's using a Chumbi. It's robotics. Things that we should be, we're essentially cutting-edge technology surveillance. We were created in 2007. We were within, if you remember NICFI, we were within a division within NICFI, and we were focusing primarily internally, but over time we've grown. And initially we were trying to just be an environment to test out things, but we tried to grow and become a little larger. We have a separate network from CDC, so we're not on the CDC network. This is the website that our lab has, and you all can access this, and I'll come back to this. It's phireseachlab.org. We consider ourselves a hybrid between Consumer Reports and Google Labs. And we can talk about the site in a bit, but as you can see, there are sections on prototypes, evaluations, we have a wiki, we have a place where you can share your ideas, and we have a lot of tools that you can look at. So we really want to be that resource so that you would say, we're looking at augmented reality XYZ. And you go to the site, you do a search, like, have you guys looked at this yet? And if we have, you can look at what our thoughts are. So we do brief reviews that is that quick, we look at this, and here's our 2 cents on this. We try to be as data-driven and as objective as possible. Given also the way our funding is designed, we are trying to be absolutely neutral, that we embrace whatever technology appears to be a good solution to meet the needs. So inside of our entity, we have 3 different small teams. One focuses on the infrastructure that I'll describe. We have a research cloud available to all of you if you want some resources. In other words, it's almost an infrastructure as a service if you need that. We'll talk about that. And the second is we needed some bright developers who I could say, come back in a week and show me this prototype if it doesn't exist. And lastly, we have our think tank, where we sit there and we discuss new issues and new technologies. Is this valuable or is this worthless? We need to get that insight and share that with you. So this is our cloud itself. So we actually have a mini data center essentially that we support, and this allows us to provide potentially roughly, in terms of storage capacity, we create virtual computers. We use VMware as our infrastructure, and on demand, we create virtual computers. We can create about 5,000 if we need to, and can provide about access to about 200 simultaneous users. So in a nutshell, this is our cloud, and we can talk about that in general, about providing this research cloud. The environments that we provide you, you have admin rights to go in and install whatever software you need to help make decisions. The only caveats are you don't use real data, it's really for a proof of concept. If the goal from this cloud is that you have a Windows 7 box and that you tried some new software and said, this new software isn't what we thought it was, that's value. You just saved yourself from going through a whole long process by using the lab. So you can see, very different kind of resources. One is infrastructure, and one is doing prototypes. So just to give you a sense of the physical lab, as I talked about, we use VMware. If you said you needed a SQL Server box or a MySQL, the only thing we can't virtualize are the Macs. Unfortunately, you have to come into our lab and use our Macs, but that's not us, that's Apple. We have a dedicated fiber connection, and we try to use some thin clients. But we have a physical space that people are using it now for sort of collaboration and user acceptance testing. So that lab, because you don't have to come to our lab to use the lab only for collaboration. As I talked about, we do have some security controls. As long as you don't put live patient data and you aren't connecting to a live medical record system, this you're okay. But we just want to make sure that what you do in the lab is really just for exploration and decision making. So you say, well, wait, if you have a cloud, what about the Amazon cloud? Why don't we just use that? That's a great question. But right now, part of it's for us to learn about the cloud by actually having a cloud. And in time, we're going to connect to the Amazon cloud such that as our capacity needs to grow, we just transparently grow into the external cloud, and you won't know the difference. So there's a lot of cloud integration occurring. We have a strong security infrastructure in place as well. And people like the fact that it's at CDC and they know. In this one case, it's a localized cloud, they know where it is. This is known as a private cloud. So just to give you a flavor, we have about 53 different projects in the lab, and we have a tool that we use to keep track of all this. It's a very simple tool, but it helps us keep track of who's using what, why they're here, what's their end goal. So it's sort of, we call this our research project management system. It's just a little MySQL tool with PHP front end for those techniques. This is just a screenshot showing you the dashboard. If you were to use our lab and you were going to log in, you'd actually see whatever you had rights to. You'd see those small screens. Those are the computers that you have rights to look at. And you just right-click on it and say reboot, and it reboots those machines. So essentially, this is a virtual computer sort of overview that you can look at. And again, this is all based on standard VMware infrastructure. So with that, I'm going to get a quick sip of water and go on with the demonstration. So I'm going to back into the demonstrations by telling you what we've learned from some of our demos. So what we've learned in general with mobile demos. ThinkStream, so this is actually verbatim from, we had a user experience design person. And I said, given everything we've been working on, what's your takeaway? What should I have people take away from all your knowledge? It's think streamlined and simple, that there's limited attention span, limited real estate, limited device memory, and maybe you're constrained, and therefore go with an idea that's simple and then grow from there. Don't try to throw everything at it. Secondly, don't just take your desktop experience and go and try to mush it down. That doesn't work. It's a famous joke that the iPad is not just a large iPhone, and you can see how, I'll show you how the apps look different. So think about really what the information you just need, which gets to this last one, provide top level need to know information at a glance and then drill down as necessary. In other words, keep it light and drill if you need to. She said it's easy to tap the wrong thing by mistake, space is key. So you have to think about my thumb, finger, your buttons are too small, and we've had lots of issues around button size, but that's an important issue when you have very little space to work with. People use their thumbs, two bars and tab bars, and most comfortable at the bottom of the screen, which is the opposite of your normal design. So, okay, for those developers, I talked to my lead developer who's on mobile, I said, okay, what should they know about mobile development? He said, go with what you know. In other words, well, I don't know Objective-C, and I know Java. Whatever you know, you can make it work. There is a platform out there, so if you don't even know either Objective-C or Java, there's now some tools out there that you can use to start to move forward. And he agrees, and painful as it is, sometimes developers aren't really focused on the design science as much as just making it work, is that the user interface really is critical. Beautiful design, a beautiful engine of an app that's got great algorithms, but a poor UI is not going to work. So that was the key. That was the takeaway from our developer. So no, really, now for some demonstration. I'm going to show you a few different prototypes, and at any point I will stop and talk to you about this. And let me just do something here for a minute. So let me just check and make sure everything's working. Okay, good. So I can fly back and forth and so it's not just all vaporware. I'll actually show you the apps running on the device so you can believe me more. First one we did is called Public Health News. The reason I'm bringing this up is because this app does work on the mobile device, and I'll show you why. So this was a novel way of visualizing Google News. So our director said, one of the things the lab should focus on is new ways of looking at data. So we took the Google News feed and said, how would this look in a smaller device that we could rapidly use some insights into this? And it leveraged something called the TreeMap algorithm. So what I'm going to show you, I'll show you the device, show you the app. All right. Just restart. So this is a screenshot of the app. And as you can see, and I'll punch over to the real one in a moment here. So this is the screenshot, and this is the real one, okay, on the iPad. So what this is doing is looking at Google News, and the larger the font size, the more frequently that article is being hit, you know, sort of a lot, very popular, and the colors represent different categories on the bottom. You can go in and say, I want red to be environmental, I want blue to be birth defects. And if you look, the smaller, the brighter the color also, the more recently it was posted in a sense. So if you just touch on this article, it will then go and show you, and you can see, it's hard to see, it says there's 394 related articles, as compared to down here, there's only 42. So this uses a tree map algorithm. It's not revolutionary, but it's just trying to say there's so much data out there, what's a quick way to visualize some of this information? This is called Health News, Public Health News. And if you then click on the actual article, it would then now launch and go to the article itself.
Come on, connection.
Yes. So, Health News, just to give you a flavor of that. So, we worked with the STD team, and they said, what about an STD app for the iPhone? And there's already some companies that want to do this and charge money. And he said, we'll work with you. Of course, it should be free. And so what we looked at was this very simple first-generation iPhone app. For those that are familiar with the iPhone, it's a very simple sort of view controller where you see the height and then sort of the header, and you touch on it and you go through the details. Very simple, very straightforward, nice first-generation. We tried some fancy stuff with search to see how searching works. It's never as simple sometimes as you the things that you think are easy end up being hard and vice versa. So what became kind of sticky was how to do search well. What should you search for anyway? So we have some challenges around search. And this is your content. But let me just show you. We then moved to the second version. And what this looks like is a little more like those familiar with Facebook's app. This has more of a dashboard feel. And you can see there's more to the app itself. These are the guidelines right here. Then there's going to be images and symptoms and treatments and search. So a richer app. And just to show you how that actually looks. And there's the app. You touch on it. There's your stuff. Not revolutionary, but still. There's still art forms in this to decide how much. See all this swiping of content? There's an even discussion about how much should they have to be swiping? How granular do you make it? So there's a continual design art form of how to best to design this. So let me just pop that in. Okay. And as you can see, more screenshots with various tools, images. So changing gears now to MMWR. This is familiar with MMWR. So the earliest proof of concept is kind of funny. Way back, literally those were the figure one, and the famous figure one has all the data about what's going on in the universe. And we just literally tried to show you that you could make this dynamic, that you could actually scroll your finger and it would show you figure one over time. Eventually our goal is, and there's some tools out there, that you can dynamically build graphs from the data. So our goal is in time to have a dynamically generated figure one on the device. We then worked with the MMWR stat and said, okay, look, what would a standard app for MMWR look like on the iPad? And it would look like this. And I'll show you this app live. Actually, let me do that. Okay, so this is the live version. Looks just like the screenshot. And so the goal is you would just say, I want to look at vital signs, I want to look at 2007, I want to read this, and here comes the vital sign. Obviously, it'll come up, so there it is. And we tried to show them, our goal from the R&D labs really to create discussion. Our goal isn't to build production apps, it's to help them think. And say, here's some options for you, what do you want to do? So we even put like related news, you can do translate. What is it that's important to you? These devices can do whatever you want. What is it you really would like to do? And we tried to show them, for example, that you can even do podcasts, and I could play the podcast right now and you hear the audio going. So just to show you what that would look like, if you clicked on this, you'll see the podcast is going to launch. You'll see a little play window, and that'll be the podcast going. Okay? And it actually does its magic. So that's what the podcast does. So let me change back. So someone may say, well, wait, why do this on the iPad? Why don't you just do it on the web? You can see there is functionality that you can have on a mobile device that you can't have on the web, where it says brightness, font size, send an email to me. I mean, yes, it's blurring, but it's very nice to have so that offline reading capability. But we're an R&D lab, and part of our challenge was to really try to turn things on their head. And we said, okay, what about the next generation? What would be, if we said, let's really show something crazy, is we said, why don't we focus on the geospatial aspect of an MMWR? And what we did was, and I'll show you this, and I can show you the live one if you like, is we took the weekly, and we used a free service from Yahoo to geocode any terms in the weekly's title that had any kind of geo-reference, like a city or a state like Houston. And then we plotted those on a map. It automatically would do that. And then if you touch on one of the thumbnail, you know, the little thumbtacks, it says there's two articles. There are the articles. You touch on the article, it shows it to you. And then we felt like on top of that, why don't we say you could actually constrain it by location, by county, state, point of interest, and that you could constrain it by a date. So you could say, please show me specifically, these any MWR that occurred in the past month 100 miles from where I'm standing. We thought that was different. So our goal was to show them that that's possible. And at this point, we're going to let the MMWR staff decide, of all of this, what features do they want to incorporate into the production version, which I am hoping will be in the near future. So to change gears, we've worked with another group at DEC, and their focus was on the suitability of content. So if they write some information for the community, is this for 8th grade level reading, is this for college level? And so we work with them on trying to create a framework to do this. And this device, this also works on a mobile device. And so the goal is we created a framework that they can look at the attributes of this content. And some of this will be done automatically and some will be done manually. But that was sort of our goal, was to try to provide some insights into how to quickly process this information. So changing gears, we worked with the laboratory team, the clinical lab team, for essentially a decision support tool for clinicians at the point of care in dealing with patients who have an abnormal lab result. Specifically, it's known as a PTT. And although in many cases you purposely want to change that value if you want to anticoagulate a patient who's got an artificial valve, in this case, these were patients that had a surprisingly abnormal PTT, and there's a long algorithm to go through to decide how to treat that patient. And so we've been working with them to take their knowledge and implement that in a mobile device. So I'm going to show you that device. So as you can see here, it's a very simple app. It's very simply designed. There's not 1,000 buttons on this. Very, very simple. Because our perspective was one of the most critical issues besides being valid is that the providers have zero tolerance for having to sit there and figure stuff out. They want this to be simple and fast to use. And so as we designed this, we tried to figure out what is the easiest way to do this. So if you think about it, if you were to create a tool where there's a long algorithm to walk down, I mean a long tree, what's the one thing you would want? And if you take a look, as you can see here, there's the controls for this. So as you go down your algorithm, as you can see, you can go back up a step, sort of down the tree, up the tree, you can restart the tree, or, and I'll show you now, you can redo you can jump to any spot you'd like. So let me just show you. So if you're seeing a patient very quickly right in front of you, and you'd say, well, clearly this is an inpatient, this is an adult, they have a history of prolonged PTT, are they currently bleeding? Yes, they are. Then it starts to say, okay, well, do they have Victor? You're walking down this decision tree. Well, do they have this deficiency? So most likely it's explained by this, and you say, continue. And then it said, well, have you done that test? Is that abnormal? No, it's not. Well, then it's most likely explained by this. And then he continues to walk down all this whole tree, but the app doesn't overwhelm you. There's a huge algorithm that it just says, hey, next step, how about this? But the kicker is, and you can see they're on step 10, if they said, no, wait a second, the resident just said I was wrong, the lab did come back, they click on this button, and they can look at all of their answers, and at any point in the step, say, wait, actually, number 5, it does not. And they would say no, and it goes, wait a second, you're going to change your answer. That's fine, but you're going to walk down a whole other tree in your algorithm. Is that what you want to do? And then you say, okay. And then you go on your way. So for us, that was the winner. There had to be a way that no matter what they did down the tree, they could always change their mind, and they would say, you need to start all over again. So far, and our goal is this should be in the hands of clinicians within our hope is, I would say, 6 to 8 months. Because we want to do a lot of beta testing to make sure they're happy with this. And the other kicker we can talk about is changing of the algorithms. And this gets into your design of your mobile app. We didn't hard code any of this where if you need to change your algorithm, you can go in and just say, I want to change this node to this node. You don't have to run to 40 places in your app. And our ultimate goal is that you can log into a website as the administrator of this tool and go ahead and change algorithms. So it's web-based, meaning that any sort of coordinator or provider can say, I have a new algorithm, I want to add that. So this is where it gets into the design of your app. How do you want to modify the app? We don't want to push it to the app store every time there's a spelling change. And that would be really poorly done. So Akka, what's up?
Do you have capable to show how you are changing the algorithm?
So when I was going to show you the Objective-C code, and the answer is, in this case, they don't want, although normally our lab is about open source, that specific group doesn't want us to share yet a lot of what they've done. So we're working with them. They have a lot of proprietary algorithms, but there's no question that when we want this code to be used for other applications, and we're going to take that code so that I think that the STD team, they wanted to use an algorithm tool to say how high are you at risk for certain STDs. So we do want to reuse this. Essentially, now we have an algorithm engine that we can implement for other environments. So if that answers your question, so. Okay. All right. Hopefully, you guys are still awake, hopefully. All right. Let me pop out of this app. Let me change gears for a second. Okay. So I think you all will love this because it's going to make you think. We've been working with the Situational Awareness Team, the CDC, and they said to us, do you have any ideas about how we could visualize social media data that potentially that could help with any kind of sense of what's going on out there? What I recently learned is that term is called communication surveillance. How is the community perceiving this outbreak? So in other words, you want to use Twitter, potentially, as a way to see how does the community perceive the messages at the state, local, or CDC that we've been trying to share. So we have a lot of challenges around the design of this. One thing I've learned is there are times we wanted to make one screen do everything, and that doesn't work. So what we try to show is you can control hour by hour or day by day based on keywords you select. And let me actually just launch the live version. Okay, here we go. So if I click on terms, you'll notice you can define whatever terms. If you're like, well, this is an earthquake, so I want earthquake, and I want broken, whatever keywords you think you might want, you can define, and this is going to pull from Twitter. Anytime that word appears, it'll start counting that. And so what we create is the first screen just gives you a flavor of, well, within the past hour, how many times was the word tired mentioned, or weak, or pain, or headache? And then if you say, well, that's a nice way to look at it, but I'd like to see what happens over time. So right now, if you look at I guess this was in the morning, these same keywords, over time, what's happening? Is there any trend, anything interesting going on? And the last screen, just to show you, this may just give you some insights, we looked at relationships. Let me just pop back to the other version real quick to show you. So this says there's a difference between if I just have the word cough in a tweet versus the word cough and the word flu in the same tweet. In other words, this is almost like a couplet or a triplet. And you can see where it says relationship is either strong, medium, or weak. So we just try and have a new way to visualize relationships of data within Twitter. The data within Twitter is very messy. Because in fever, you've got disco fever, boogie fever, lots of odd stuff. But so there's two battles one to fight. One is about the quality of the data, and the second is, what is the best way to visualize this? So we really try to think about this in terms of, I want to navigate by hour, I want to jump to a specific point in time. How to design this to provide a quick sort of general overview, and then a quick guide if you need it. So I want to give you that flavor of that. Just very briefly, we work with NIOSH, just to show them they've got a lot of data on the NIOSH website. Well, what would some of that huge database look like if you put that on an iPhone? Well, very straightforward, it would show you all the various masks, and then the details, and then a link to click to it. So very straightforward. We worked with ATSTR and said, look, you have your tox guide. Well, very straightforward, how would a tox guide look on an iPhone? In this case, it's an iPad, but it really is an iPhone. I just enlarged it so you can see it. So very straightforward. We worked with another group, which we called Athena, which was saying, is there a way that if I'm a clinician, I order a test, whether I order from LabCorp or Quest, they have different names. Whether you're a lab, you know, a hemoglobin A1C with LabCorp may be a different name than at Quest. And we tried to work with them on a tool to try to create a simple repository for that. So in all this use of HTML5, so it can be used on a small device as well. Just coming back, this is our website again, and I'm happy to take questions about all this information you try to put on the website and show this, so you can read about these various apps and prototypes. And with that, I think I will take any questions you have. Okay.
So, you have cloud available and you're doing some very interesting, wonderful work inside. If I have a great idea,
yes,
ever, that's going to change public health, and I pitch it for you,
yes,
you will write a check and get your developers on it, or?
So I guess I'm your VC.
Yes.
So in a sense, so we prioritize our limited resources in order of what we feel like appear to be big bang for the buck. And so if when you present to me, I'm right, this is revolutionary, I'll take a chunk of the resources if you need us to help with the development. But if you just said, look, I just want to come to your lab and I want to use your Macs to have our people write code, we can, of course, work with you. But yeah, if you come to us and say, I don't just need a VM, I want to come to you and I want to joint venture, talk to us and we'll make it work. So, yeah.
I have a question about, I guess, the beta testing. You mentioned, I was wondering, like, how much of it is the, like, for example, MMWR saying, well, this is what we think we want our users to be able to do, versus then you test with those, your audiences, and they say, oh, yeah, this is perfect, or no, this is not what we want at all. How much of the user piece comes in earlier, and is there kind of like a certain formula that those people developing need to use, or does it really totally depend on feedback?
It really varies. I think that's what we found is we've seen a tremendous, if someone says, what's the value of your lab? And we're finding in some cases, it's just a consultation discussing, they even say, how much is it going to cost to build an app? Versus, and sometimes once they build the web-based app, they use our lab and they bring in people and they sit around the table and they discuss it. So really, it's becoming a case-by-case basis. Unfortunately, everyone needs to be a little different. Great question. Any other questions? Yes?
Have you looked into or thought about liability aspects, in particular with applications like the PTC or financial payment, maybe health-related decisions based on?
Sure. So just to give you a sense again, our lab is not, we are the germinator of this, that once it's essentially ready and they're happy, it's given to the program, and the program decides they're willing to take that responsibility on to release it. And I think, as with any application, there's a couple of issues. One is that the app has to function, and secondly, is it providing the right information? And part of that is those algorithms, and that they need to take responsibility for the algorithms. And as usual, of course, there's usual disclaimers on applications saying you take responsibility for this. But yeah, I think that's part of the challenge that we make sure that, I think for our liability issues is to make sure that no real data, if our lab is ever hacked, that's for us more important, that we have a lot of stuff I would show you in terms of open source and a lot of other codes. And just to show you briefly, for example, we've got, if you bear with me for one moment, here it comes with my code. We have a website that has open source and a code repository, and there's always issues around what if someone goes in there and tries to hack it, and so there's always inherent risk, I think, with what we're dealing with, and we just try to be as smart as we can.
Yeah, I'm asking because, you know, I can easily see where you might not want to see me pursue or give an application because no matter what you do, the liability asset
Right, no, that I think we'll talk to the lab team as this evolves and if they're willing to take that on.
Sure.
You guys have one more question or
one more question.
Yes.
A lot of the devices you're showing have IT security issues. Are you also working in your lab to address any of those so people can use those devices?
All right, that's a great question. I really do want to ask this because all right. So the answer is yes. You want to take this one?
Because at CDC we work around this because the only real approved mobile device is a BlackBerry and a small subset of Windows tablets. The nice thing is HTML5 apps are, they're web-based. So if your program can publish websites, then you're in HTML5, and you're really bound by web security controls, which programs are already working around. So that sort of covers all the HTML5 web-based apps. The reality is that if you poll everyone who works for a state or a federal agency who has an iPhone, who uses it for work, that number is extraordinarily high, and they're using that outside of the security policies of their organizations. So taking that into account, we actually do work with our information system security officers to see what the security implications and the risk profile is of these applications, because we understand that even though this app is not in the App Store and it can't be used on official CDC devices, it still is being used by public health workers on their personal devices. We've seen physicians who have EMRs on a laptop, and they have their personal iPad next to them entering public health information, which they're not supposed to. The patient health data is on these personal devices because they're owned by clinicians, and they're owned by workers. So that's sort of our perspective of everything we do is in compliance to CDC security policy, but we're working with it. If these apps were used, how would risk profile would work, and how users can sort of live with themselves as they use them.
I got a call from a physician who's talking about their text messaging other physicians about patients. And there's a lot of issues around that. And it's social engineering. People are going to be doing this, so we can't say stop doing it. We have to figure out
how to control
that. So that answers your question.
Let's have a round of applause for Dr. Savelle.